Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. I'm Will Aitchison. I'll be with you for the next 45 minutes or so as we go over recent developments in the public safety world. First of all, I want to bring you up to date with what's going on with LRIS. As I've mentioned, we had to cancel our grievances seminar that was going to be held in September in Las Vegas. Las Vegas has simply not made the comeback yet that would allow meetings to take place in the city. We are told that the rules right now are that no meeting greater than 50 can take place in Las Vegas. You can only imagine how much that devastates the Clark County community, with basically all of the convention business going away. It's hard to tell what the trends are right now on the pandemic. You see different trend lines almost from day to day, and we check an awful lot of them. It is looking better right now in the next two cities where we have seminars, in Nashville, where we have our wellness seminar in October, and in Las Vegas, where we have our advanced police discipline seminar in November. But we're just simply not going to put anybody at risk in order to hold a seminar. So we're going to keep monitoring it, and we promise everybody who's registered for those seminars, we'll make a decision whether or not we're going to go ahead with them, giving 30 days advance notice. One thing all of this business with the pandemic and the seminars has given us the experience of is something that's called a force majeure clause in a contract. I actually don't think I have seen or read anything about a force majeure clause in a contract since arguably I was in law school, and maybe not even then. What is such a clause? It's a clause that says, look, if really bad stuff happens, neither side has to go through with its obligations under the contract. Turns out all of these contracts we have with hotels that host our seminars have a force majeure clause. And the clause that we have, for example, the one we have with Caesars Entertainment, which is what owns the Flamingo, that clause says that an act of God will excuse the party's obligations under the contract. And an act of God has all sorts of definitions, you might imagine, earthquakes, etc., etc. And also any event that makes the seminar, in our case, or the meeting, financially impracticable. So we thought, well, we're well covered by the force majeure clause. If you cancel these seminars, you get all sorts of penalties. And believe it or not, it's not as straightforward as that. Turns out these hotel companies really want to hold on to you. Thankfully, we've been able to work out arrangements with Flamingo Hotel and Caesars, where we've been for many, many years, and also with the Luxor, where we're going to have our seminars next year. But it just seemed to be a little bit more difficult than you would otherwise think it might have to be. But we will persevere on that. So what are we doing with these seminars? We are going to convert any canceled seminar to a webinar format. And first one up is going to be that grievances seminar. We are going to do a mix of live webinars and recorded webinars. Most of them are going to be live. We're trying out the technology right now, making sure that it works. We want to be able to have Q&A sessions during the course of the webinars. And we're going to break these seminars up into collections of webinars, 5, 6, 7 different webinars, whatever it might be. We're also doing the same thing for the Rights of Police seminar that we had to cancel way back in June. That was a seminar that we were going to hold concurrently with the release of the 8th edition of my book on the rights of law enforcement officers. So now we're going to put it out in webinar format. All these webinars are going to start in October, so make sure you check your email. We'll get notice to you as to how you can register for them and all of that sort of stuff. I have been going through the process of converting the PowerPoint presentations that we use for our seminars into webinar format. And it turns out that what might work in a seminar where you have a couple hundred people, that's not necessarily going to work in a smaller webinar type setting. So it's been taking a lot of work to convert these things. It's also given me the opportunity to go out there and research, you know, different information than we've had in these PowerPoints. Some of these PowerPoints we've used for years, they're very effective. And I've got to tell you, at times, it's just been a whole lot of fun. So for the Rights of Police seminar or webinar, we're going to do a segment on the Fair Labor Standards Act, wages and hours and overtime and comp time and all that sort of stuff. In putting together the webinar, I was able to go out there and find a picture of Franklin Roosevelt signing the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938. But better yet, I was able to find the audio of his fireside chat where he signed and described the Fair Labor Standards Act. And if you are an FLSA junkie like I am, man, that's really cool. And I also was able to find a picture of and a newspaper article about Police Chief Eddie Garrity, the Garrity of Garrity versus New Jersey. Garrity turned out to be a police chief in New Jersey, really a Philadelphia suburb, who was being prosecuted for bribery. And there's this great picture of him that's just, you know, you can tell the time and place where that picture was taken just by looking at it. And the newspaper article is next to hilarious. At any rate, just all of that by way of saying that we're taking seriously this opportunity to update all our materials, not just with stuff from 1938 and 1966, but update it and do new research. And these webinars, I think, are going to be really, really informative. We're trying to make them in bite-sized pieces, so the webinars will be usually 90 minutes long, in some cases 60 minutes long. And what we'll do is put together a package of them for a seminar so you can sign up for them at a discounted rate if you sign up for all the webinars. You can, of course, view them at your leisure, even if they're live. And with every webinar is going to come all the materials we've collected, and as well, an electronic version of the 8th edition of the Rights of Law Enforcement Officer book. So, at any rate, that's a little bit of details as to what's going on with us. Now let's dive into the cases. And the first one we've got is a case out of Newark, New Jersey. And it's a really good reminder, I think, for employers about their grievance procedures, to pay attention to your grievance procedures. Why? Well, let me tell you what the story is in this case. The city of Newark has a collective bargaining agreement with the Newark Police Superior Officers Association. The Superior Officers Association represents officers in the ranks of sergeant, lieutenant, and captain. And I got to say something about the association, just in passing. The longtime president of the association is a guy named John Crystal. John has come to many of our seminars. And, you know, there are people who come to our seminars who, you know, come spend 3 days in Las Vegas and go home. And it not too much of the material sticks with them. That's not John. John comes to these seminars, goes back to Newark, and all of a sudden you see a spate of new grievances or unfair labor practice complaints that are filed. And I swear to you, John has as good as, if not a better, one-loss record than any lawyer I know handling these unfair labor practice complaints and grievances. He's not a lawyer. You don't have to be a lawyer to be in this business. And John is proof positive of that. Anyway, on to this grievance. So in 2013, the association files a grievance with the city. And the grievance says, hey, look, you are calculating our payouts on comp time. Whenever you make those payments, you're calculating them wrong. You're not including longevity in the comp time payments. And under the collective bargaining agreement, you've got to include longevity. The association files this grievance at step one. It finally makes it to step five of the grievance procedure, which is the office of the police director, essentially the police chief in Newark. And the police director at the time, he's since retired, was a fellow named Samuel DeMaio. And DeMaio granted the grievance. And he ruled, and I'm going to quote, when active members receive their comp time payments, they are entitled to receive longevity as part of those payments. And so DeMaio orders city staff to go back and do the recalculations and include longevity in the comp time payments. Let me pause for a moment, go off onto an aside here, and let's talk about the Fair Labor Standards Act. Under the FLSA, when a payment is made for comp time, does it have to include longevity? Well, remember, under the FLSA, you got overtime that is overtime under a contract, but not necessarily overtime over the FLSA's overtime thresholds. And then also you have overtime that is FLSA overtime. It's overtime that's regulated by the federal law because it's over the FLSA's overtime thresholds. So for police officers, it might be it's hours worked over 171 in a 28-day period. That's FLSA overtime. The rule under the FLSA, if you cash out comp time, it must be paid at the regular rate of pay. And that includes all remuneration for employment, which would include longevity. So if this comp time that's being cashed out in Newark is FLSA comp time, it always should have included longevity. My guess is that it was contract overtime. Overtime that was earned under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement before employees got to the FLSA's overtime threshold. And contract overtime or contract comp time can be paid at any rate that is negotiated between the parties. So, at any rate, that's just an aside on how the FLSA plays into this question of the cash out of comp time. So, back to 2013. Police Director DeMaio grants the grievance. The city doesn't really like what DeMaio has done, but doesn't do anything about it. In fact, it doesn't even start including longevity in the comp time payouts. And eventually, takes about a year or so, the Superior Officers Association files an unfair labor practice charge, alleging that the city's failure to comply with DeMaio's decision effectively repudiated the collective bargaining agreement. That's an unfair labor practice in many states. And it goes to a hearing officer before New Jersey's Public Employment Relations Commission. And what does the hearing officer say? I'll give you the translation and then I'll give you the quote. The translation is to say to the employer, look, if you give somebody decision-making authority in the grievance procedure and they make a decision, you're stuck with it. You can't simply disregard that decision. Now, I'll tell you what the hearing officer said. Quote, the commission, the Public Employment Relations Commission, has held that an employer's refusal to abide by a decision of its designated grievance representative constitutes a refusal to negotiate in good faith. Why? Quote, If the parties are not bound by the results of the intermediate steps of a grievance procedure they intended to be binding, then the procedure will be ineffective in quickly and inexpensively resolving disputes. Bottom line, quote, an employer will be bound by its negotiated grievance procedure and the decisions of the agents it has authorized to represent it at each step. So when I started this segment by saying, employers, there's a big lesson here for you about your grievance procedures. The lesson is, if you don't want to have somebody making decisions in the grievance procedure that will bind you, you need to revisit your grievance procedures. And maybe you want to truncate them. Maybe you don't want to have a step one or step two or whatever it might be. But this is a good cause to dust off your grievance procedure and take a look at it. Now, this is not novel law. There are cases like this really all over the country. And I simply have to tell you my favorite case. And it comes out of Maine. This is an old one. This is maybe 25 years old, 30 years old. It's an older case. And it's a case where the grievance procedure, step one of the grievance procedure, starts with the rank of sergeant. And it involves the Maine State Police. So you have a trooper who is fired, files a grievance, goes to step one of the grievance procedure. Sergeant takes a look at it and says, you know what? I think the chief was wrong. I'm going to grant this grievance, reinstate this trooper. The state of Maine sees that result and says, no, we're not going to comply with that. We're not going to accept the proposition that a sergeant can overturn the chief's decision in a grievance procedure. And eventually the thing winds up before the Maine Supreme Court, which says to the state, you know what? You gave that sergeant decision-making authority in the grievance procedure. You're stuck with it. Reinstate the trooper. And I looked, but I was never able to find whatever small island it must have been off the coast of Maine to which that sergeant was assigned for the rest of his career. But knowing state police agencies, I'm pretty sure that happened. Next up, I've got an arbitration case. An arbitration case with pretty difficult facts, but I think it's really important. There's a huge focus right now around the country as part of the police reform effort to take a look at arbitration and perhaps to move away from arbitration as a system of appealing discipline. I think, having read so many of these arbitration opinions, that effort could not be more ill-advised, could not be more ill-founded on the facts, but nonetheless, you see potential changes in state laws regarding arbitration. We've already seen it in Minnesota, where most disciplinary appeals are going to wind up before one of six arbitrators in the state who cannot hear other than police arbitration decisions. That will be their entire source of livelihood. Pretty much you can tell the intent of the authors of that bill is that those six arbitrators, first of all, they're not going to be experienced arbitrators, because who would take that job if the only cases you can get are police discipline cases? And secondly, it's very clear those arbitrators are going to be beholden to the state of Minnesota for all of their work. That doesn't sound like a very neutral system. You've also seen a change in Oregon to arbitration, where arbitrators have to follow a collectively bargained disciplinary matrix. And it's even more than that they have to follow it. If the employer's decision comes down somewhere on the matrix and the arbitrator finds that the officer engaged in misconduct, the arbitrator may not overturn the employer's decision even if the penalty selected is, in the eyes of the arbitrator, grossly disproportionate. So let's say, for example, you have a disciplinary matrix where one of the offenses is insubordination, and the disciplinary range is oral reprimand to termination. And you see that on these disciplinary matrices from time to time, these huge sweeping disciplinary ranges. And let's say the officer does something very minor and the employer fires him, and it ends up in arbitration. If the arbitrator finds that that officer in fact did commit insubordination, even though that arbitrator would believe that an oral reprimand or a written reprimand would be appropriate, under the new Oregon law, the arbitrator must sustain the termination because the termination was somewhere on the matrix. So we see these challenges now to arbitration, statutory challenges to arbitration, based on, again, what I believe to be the completely fallacious notion that employers simply can't win these cases in arbitration. They do. The facts show that. The facts show employers win right around 50% of arbitration cases. And the facts show that very, very, very few cases ever end up in arbitration, because most often unions don't challenge discipline that is meted out because the discipline is fair. But nonetheless, you do see these attacks. And the case I'm about to describe to you from Ohio, I fear is going to give some fodder for those attacks. So what is the case? It involves a corrections corporal who works for Cuyahoga County, Ohio. And his name is Brendan Johnson. In 2016, he responds to a call of a female inmate. This is an inmate who has a long history of noncompliance with any corrections department rules. On this case, she has intentionally jammed her toilet, flooding her cell in the offing. She's sitting up on a bunk when Johnson arrives. Johnson orders her to come down. She refuses. After a while, she comes down. Johnson asks her, "Why'd you flood your cell?" She doesn't answer. He repeats the question. She doesn't answer. He asks her, "Why aren't you answering my questions?" And she said, "I don't want to talk to you." And as a result of all of that, Johnson sprays pepper foam in the inmate's face while simultaneously telling her, quote, "I told you I would get you." This was Johnson's fourth interaction with the inmate during that shift. 2 days later, Johnson responds to the mental health unit to assist another corrections officer with a female inmate who was refusing to disrobe. Johnson led the inmate into her cell, ordered her to remove her clothing. After repeated directives, the inmate complied, although she was dancing and gyrating and looking at Johnson, and she was singing, quote, "Wanting to see my titties and make pedophiles happy." Eventually, she removed her clothes from the waist up, turned her back to Johnson, and bent over in a seductive manner to remove her pants. I can only imagine how seductive all of that must have been. According to Johnson, the inmate brushed up against him. He deployed a leg sweep, causing her to fall to the ground. Once she was on the ground, the inmate repeatedly failed to comply with Johnson's commands to stop resisting and give up. Johnson eventually sprays pepper foam into her face while she was on the ground. The county fires Johnson. His union is Local 70 of the United Auto Workers. I haven't seen the United Auto Workers representing a police or firefighter unit in years and years and years. But, you know, we're in the Rust Belt here, so that's still a possibility, or clearly it is a reality. The case goes to arbitration, and the arbitrator ends up concluding that termination is not appropriate. Why? Because Johnson has 16 years of service, consistently favorable performance evaluations since he was hired 16 years before. And the arbitrator concludes that progressive discipline means that an employee shouldn't be terminated unless and until, quote, it is clear that he will not or cannot respond to lesser penalties imposed with progressive severity. The arbitrator ordered a 15-month time-served suspension without pay. So Johnson's taking a big hit here, right? He's taking certainly a multi-$10,000 hit. So probably given salaries there, this is probably a $40,000 or $50,000 penalty. The county challenges the arbitrator's decision by filing a lawsuit that ends up in the Ohio Court of Appeals. And what the county's argument is the arbitrator's decision violates an explicit public policy that corrections officers not use unnecessary force. And usually, arbitration is final and binding, but there is this public policy exception where a court will not enforce an arbitrator's decision if it finds that the decision violates an explicit and clearly documented public policy. What does the Court of Appeals do with this? It rejects the challenge. The court says to the county, you've framed the public policy issue incorrectly. The question is not whether unnecessary force violates public policy. Everybody agrees with that. The union agrees with it. Johnson agrees. Everyone agrees with that. The question is whether the arbitrator's opinion violates public policy. And that means the real question is the reinstatement of a corrections officer who used unnecessary force, does that violate public policy? And here's the court's answer, and I'm going to quote. There is nothing in the law prohibiting reinstatement of employees found to have used excessive force. The inquiry is not whether Johnson's conduct itself violates public policy, but whether the arbitrator's decision will have the effect of violating public policy. Although the use of excessive force violates Ohio's policy requiring the sheriff to keep inmates safe, an arbitrator's decision to reinstate an employee who used excessive force does not necessarily violate public policy if the arbitrator's decision is otherwise reasonable in its terms for reinstatement. And in looking at the reasonableness, the court looks at all the factors you might expect in a case like this. Got a longtime employee? Check off the box. Consistently favorable employment evaluations? Check off the box. Has he been promoted? Check off the box. Is he considered a viable candidate for promotion to sergeant? Check off the box. Have there been prior instances where Johnson has lost his cool like this? No. Check off the box. So the court ends up saying, look, the arbitrator's decision here is just simply not contrary to public policy. You can keep inmates safe by requiring Johnson to undergo retraining on the use of force and the management of mentally ill inmates. Now, back to the police reform efforts. We are starting to see signs in the police reform movement that they get this public policy thing. And by get this public policy thing, I mean that they are trying to legislate it out of existence. So we see, for example, in Colorado, in the police reform statute there, that if someone is guilty of excessive force, they're simply going to bypass the appeal process. They will lose their certification to be a police officer without regard to any mitigating circumstances or factors such as the court and the arbitrator considered in the Johnson case. By the way, back to webinars for a moment. I've been tracking these police reform bills, And I have put together a webinar. We'll probably release it in October, a webinar on the primary thrusts of the police reform statutes that have passed around the country. And I'll tell you, these statutes are astonishing in their breadth and what it is they do. So far, I have put together pieces of police reform legislation from Connecticut, New York, District of Columbia, Minnesota, California, Nevada, Oregon, all sorts of Colorado, of course, a wide variety of different states. And I think when you hear this webinar, you'll be shocked at a couple of things. First, how sweeping these police reform efforts are into the employment environment, sweeping in a way that when you see many of them, you just simply have to shake your head and say, if someone wants to become a police officer in that state, that maybe by definition should be a failure of the psychological examination as to whether they're fit for duty. Why would you ever want to be a cop under these circumstances? That's the first thing you're struck with. The second thing you're struck with is are the tactics that are being used. By and large, these bills are passing on what people in the legislative business call the gut and stuff technique. What's the gut and stuff technique? You take a bill that is a non-controversial bill that's been kind of just hanging around in the legislature. You wait till the last minute when the time for hearings is passed, and then whoever it was who proposed that bill simply amends it and amends everything that was in that bill out of existence. That's the gut. And then stuffs it with police reform measures. No hearings. And in some of the cases with the police reform legislation, and I'm not making this up, the legislation was introduced, passed by both houses of the legislature, and signed by the governor in less than 24 hours. No public hearings, no public input. Due process is not something police officers are seeing right now before state legislatures. And let me tell you how bad these bills are. I'm going to give you one in California that actually didn't pass. It didn't pass because the legislature adjourned on Monday night at midnight, but it came awfully close, and the proponents are saying it's going to be back. And this is just one piece of this California legislation. I just want to show you how far this goes. So right now, California is only one of five states that doesn't have a system for decertifying police officers, removing their post certificates. I think pretty much everybody agrees there should be that sort of system. So what did this bill do? This bill that looked until just about 11:59 p.m. on Monday was going to pass. It created a separate board in California's Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission, a board of nine people that would be the decertification board. Who were these nine human beings? Well, three of them, and only three of them, could have law enforcement backgrounds. Two of them at the chief or sheriff level, and one of them who commanded an internal affairs unit. Two of them had to be from advocacy groups suing police. Another two had to be from community or non-profit groups whose mission was police reform. The eighth had to be a lawyer who specialized in suing police. And the ninth, and I'm not making this up, had to be a, quote, victim of police abuse. So you had this committee stacked on a 6-3 basis with not only non-law enforcement personnel, and what other profession, by the way, do we regulate with commissions like this that are made up of just our majority of members of the public? Do we regulate doctors or dentists or psychologists? No, of course, we don't regulate any other profession like that. So you had this 6-3 super majority of people who came in with an expressed view that police abuse people. All right? So what would happen with decertification? This entity would have the ability to hire an investigator. The investigator would make recommendations to this board. The board would vote on whether the officer should be decertified. If the officer disagreed, the officer would appeal to the full Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission, and then the commission would make the final decision. At no point in the process was the officer allowed a hearing, the opportunity to introduce any evidence, or to confront the evidence against him. And this almost passed and will be back. That's what we're seeing around the country. So, at any rate, if you're interested in that issue, watch your email box, because we will be getting out news of the webinar on police reform legislation. And by the way, if you're a firefighter, don't think you're immune from this sort of legislation. Some of it already hits all public safety employees, not just police officers. And, you know, remember the old adage, they may be coming for one group right now. Their success in doing so makes you an easier target. Next case I'd like to talk about is a Brady case that comes to us out of the North Dakota Supreme Court. I can tell you, you virtually never see any labor cases of any consequence coming out of the North Dakota Supreme Court. And I think that's because, A, they don't have unions in North Dakota, police or fire unions, and B, they don't have that many people in North Dakota, so you just don't have that much litigation. So what's going on in this case? It's a little bit of a chink in the armor of prosecutorial immunity. So this case starts 2017 when an assistant Burley County state's attorney, who's got the wonderful name of Julie Lawyer, you can't make this up, right? She gets an anonymous letter concerning a Bismarck police officer's alleged destruction of evidence. The letter prompts Lawyer to review the files of all police personnel in Bismarck, which is about 100 people. And as a result, she ends up reviewing the file of Sergeant Robin Kreil. Lawyer decides Kreil was dishonest in a couple of investigations in which she ended up receiving a letter of reprimand. Lawyer then makes a phone call to the police chief and says, hey, look, I've got Brady Giglio concerns with this sergeant as to whether or not she can testify, because I'm going to have to disclose the fact that I think she was dishonest. The chief says, you're wrong. She wasn't dishonest. I don't see the dishonesty that you think is right. Despite what the chief had to say, a lawyer then sent a letter to the chief summarizing her investigation, stating her beliefs that Kreil had been dishonest in making false statements in these investigations, and telling the chief that since this information would have to be disclosed to the defense in cases where Kreil was involved, the Burley County State's Attorney's Office would no longer use Kreil as a witness in its cases. Let's stop right there, because say whatever you might want to say about whether we've got sort of a Les Miserables, Inspector Javert thing going on with the... I almost said the lawyer, with Lawyer in this case, that she's sort of in this relentless pursuit of Kreis. Say what you want about that. She's clearly wrong in her decision that she has to no longer use Kreis as a witness in the case. All she has to do under Brady is disclose this information. That doesn't mean that Kreis can't be an effective witness. So, but I think that's kind of what you would expect when you probably don't get a lot of these Brady cases in the Burley County State's Attorney's Office in North Dakota. So at any rate, the chief gets this letter, decides, well, if she can't testify, I can't use her. The chief fires Kreis. Kreis files a complaint against the Department of Labor and Human Rights, saying she's been discriminated against based on her race and sex. She also files a lawsuit in state court against lawyer claiming defamation of character. And what is she claiming in this lawsuit? She's saying, lawyer defamed me in three ways. First of all, by sending that letter to the Bismarck Police Department, specifically Chief Donlan. Secondly, in that Department of Labor and Human Rights investigation, she provided affidavits about her conclusions as to why Kreis was dishonest. And third, lawyer sent a letter to the state's post board detailing why she thought Kreis was dishonest. So this lawsuit goes all the way up to the North Dakota Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has to decide whether or not lawyers' communications are protected by the notion of absolute prosecutorial immunity. Now, just to reset for you, there are two types of immunity in the law. One is called absolute immunity, and one is called qualified immunity. Absolute immunity means you can't be sued. No matter what your motivation was, no matter if your heart was as black as it possibly could be, you can't be sued. If you intended to harm someone and you knew what you were saying was false, you can't be sued if you're covered by absolute immunity. Qualified immunity means you are immune from lawsuit unless you acted maliciously. And if you acted maliciously, then the immunity evaporates and you can be sued. Prosecutorial immunity is almost always absolute immunity. And citing the doctrine of absolute immunity, the North Dakota Supreme Court says, look, at its heart, a lawyer's decision not to use Kreis as a witness, that's a prosecutorial decision. And that is covered by absolute immunity. Prosecutors are immune from any lawsuit that results out of the initiation or pursuit of a criminal prosecution and how the state's case is presented at trial. However, when the prosecutor is functioning not as a prosecutor, but as an administrator or investigative officer, instead of as an advocate, they've only got qualified immunity. And here, lawyers' decision to send the letter to the chief, she wasn't prosecuting somebody when she did that. She was acting as an administrator, so she only has qualified immunity. Same thing, or not same thing, a different thing, different result, with respect to the letter to the post board. The court says, we just don't have enough evidence on why it was lawyer sent this letter to the post board. If that letter was part of official post proceedings that involved the decertification of Kreis, then all documents that are part of official proceedings, like evidence that is admitted into trial and the like, all of that is absolutely privileged. We just don't know whether she did that in conjunction with official legal proceedings. And then lastly, what about the letter to the Department of Labor? court says, we know that was part of the Department of Labor's investigation. That's part of official proceedings, therefore covered by absolute immunity. So what's the scorecard when we get out of the North Dakota Supreme Court? The scorecard is Kreil can maintain her lawsuit against lawyer for the letter to the chief and may be able to do so for the letter to post, depending on what was going on in post at the time. Absolute immunity means that Kreil can't sue for the Department of Labor letter or for lawyer's decision not to use her as a witness. Interesting case, and a little bit of a chink in the armor of absolute prosecutorial immunity. I want to conclude with a Facebook case. This one involves an EMS captain in the city of Cleveland, Ohio. We have seen so many Facebook cases in the last 4 months. It's been really astonishing, both police and fire Facebook cases, all coming out of the death of George Floyd, and then the protests in the wake of that, and then the violence that sometimes accompanies the protests. And we have police officers and firefighters all over the country just losing their jobs right and left because they think that their Facebook posts are entitled to some sort of complete protection under the First Amendment to the Constitution. They're not. And I've said that so many times on this podcast, I'm not going to get into detail on it. And it's with that reservation that I talk about this federal case involving the EMS captain, because it's actually a case where the court ends up saying that a Facebook post, a racially tinged Facebook post, may be constitutionally protected. Not is constitutionally protected, maybe. We don't know whether it is because of where this case is in the litigation process. So what's the case about? It involves a fellow named Jamie Marquardt, and he works for the City of Cleveland's Department of Emergency Medical Services. He has a private Facebook page. Always when you hear private Facebook page, put the word private in quotes, because nothing is private, okay? And there's no such thing as a private Facebook page. Make sure your employees, your members know that. At any rate, Marquardt's Facebook page does not identify him as a city employee. 14 months after a Cleveland police officer shot and killed 12-year-old Tamir Rice, a post appears on Marquardt's page, and it says, quote, "Let me be the first on record to have the balls to say Tamir Rice should have been shot, and I'm glad he is dead. I wish I was in the park that day as he terrorized innocent patrons by pointing a gun at them, walking around, acting bad. I am upset. I did not get the chance to kill the criminal fucker." Someone by the name of Kevin, who's apparently one of Marquardt's cousins, posted a comment in reply, and then a second post comes up on Marquardt's page that says, quote, "Stop, Kevin. How would you feel if you were walking in the park and some ghetto rat pointed a gun in your face? Would you look to him as a hero? Cleveland sees this felony hood rat as a hero." Marquardt removes those posts within hours, and later, in the course of an internal investigation, said he didn't make the post, that an acquaintance with access to his phone made the post while he slept. The EMS commissioner filed a complaint with the city of Cleveland against Marquardt. He's fired. He sues, brings a lawsuit in federal court saying my speech was protected under the First Amendment. And the trial court kicks the case out on a very narrow basis. The trial court says These posts did not amount to speech on a matter of public concern. The posts only concerned a matter of private interest. And Facebook posts or any speech by a public employee that concern a matter of private interest as opposed to public concern are not protected under the First Amendment. And since these posts about Tamir Rice only dealt with the private views of Marquardt, therefore they are not protected by the First Amendment. And Marquardt appeals. And that issue goes to the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And the court makes what I think is a very easy decision. And that is the trial court was wrong. The public discussion about Tamir Rice, the actions of the officer who shot Tamir Rice, the gun that was being carried by Tamir Rice, which was a replica gun that for all the world looked like a real gun, Rice's age, the race of the people, of all those things were public discussions, very, very public discussions. And here's the way the court puts it. The posts on Marquardt's Facebook page made certain assertions about the well-documented shooting that plausibly relate to the officer's handling of the encounter and the resulting community reaction. In the posts, the author seems to assert that Rice's shooting was justified because he was terrorizing people by pointing a gun at them. The posts also assert that Rice, due to his conduct at the time of the killing, should not be viewed as a hero by Clevelanders. Given the widespread local and national scrutiny of the Rice shooting, these aspects of the post directly relate to a subject of general interest and of value and concern to the public. So the court sends the case back down to the trial court for the rest of the case. So what's the rest of the case? Marquardt hasn't won this whole case yet, far from it. Because the rest of the case is going to be, you know, of course, did Marquardt make the post, right? That would seem to be one issue, a factual issue that's going to have to be resolved. And secondly, simply because something is a matter of public interest doesn't mean it's constitutionally protected. The employer's interest can override the employee's interest in speaking out if the speech causes actual disruption in the workplace. Not theoretical disruption, but actual reduction. And the court's going to have to sort that out. And you can imagine what the city's case is going to be. And you can also imagine what Marquardt's case is going to be. So this case, I think, is important because it does focus us on one of the elements of a free speech claim related to a Facebook or social media post. And that element is, even if the language that is used is harsh, even if the language that is used is offensive, that post can still be constitutionally protected if it is about a matter of public interest. The way courts put this is the First Amendment is robust enough to have to deal with potentially offensive speech. Here's the way the Sixth Circuit put it in its opinion in Marquardt's case. Quote, the First Amendment is not so fragile that its guarantees rise or fall with the pronouns a speaker selects. Expressions of opinion, even distasteful ones, do not become matters of personal interest as opposed to public interest simply because they are phrased in the first person or reflect a personal desire. All right, that's it for our September First Thursday podcast. I want to thank you all for joining us, and above all, I want to thank all of you for hanging in there with LRIS as we work really, really hard to save this service that we, all of us who are with LRAS, have come to really love. And hopefully you'll tune in for some of these webinars. In the grievances webinars, by the way, we'll have Anil Karia, my law partner, doing a 90-minute presentation on nothing but social media, looking at the Marquardt case again. We hope you'll join in there, and hopefully we can get back to business pretty soon, doing these seminars and seeing you in public. So with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Be safe out there.